Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I sit down with actor and former trumpet player, Zach Woods. We all know that adolescence is rife with tumultuous changes, puberty, pimples, and braces, but those are also our formative years, and our artistic identities begin to take shape. And no one I knew took more of a left turn, post-orthodontist, than Zach Woods. You see, Zach really wanted to be a jazz musician. And as a highly motivated kid, he would force himself to practice trumpet for hours a day with a Spartan-like self-inflicted discipline, complete with a fedora. But things changed when Zach got braces. Unable to practice, he reluctantly let go of his dream to become the next Miles Davis and instead filled his newfound free time with an improv class at Upright Citizens Brigade in New York City. Surprisingly, for someone who was so rigid in his approach to the arts, Zach was drawn to the high-wire nature of improv comedy. As he says, the threat of humiliation is so present in the moment that you can't look ahead or back. It's like a weird, terror-based form of meditation. But discomfort is the price of doing something worthwhile, and Zach quickly rose up the ladder at UCB. By the time he was in college at New York University's Tisch School, he was teaching improv to adults twice his age. These days, Zach is known for his television roles like the motherly Jared Dunn in Silicon Valley and the duplicitous Gabe in The Office. But he is still considered a master improviser by those who work with him, like Silicon Valley creator Mike Judge and fellow terror meditators Thomas Middleditch, Kumail Nanjiani, and Martin Starr. This unlikely troupe of comedic actors have created a unique bond in Silicon Valley, propelling the show to 5 successful seasons and counting, despite them all being, in Zach's words, a lot worse looking than their stand-ins. Zach joins off camera to discuss the strange characters who influenced his childhood, why Jared is a bit more like Zach than he would like to admit, how it's possible that he was cursed by his Wiccan piano teacher, and why he starts every day with a death prayer. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hi, Zach.
Hi, Sam.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Thank you for doing this.
Oh, I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you, and I'm a big Silicon Valley fan, and I've had 2 other cast members on the show. We had Thomas Middleditch, we had Kumail. But, you know, I wanted to have you on for a long time because I think that in some ways you're the heart of that show, and without your character, I feel like it would be more of a satire. You know what I mean?
That's such a sweet thing to say. Jesus. Well, it's nice. I think there's something like about Mike Judge generally that I like, which is that when he satirizes something, he makes fun of it in a way that doesn't feel like he's making fun of it from on high. It doesn't feel like he's sneering or like looking down on the characters. I feel like the general attitude seems to be kind of like, aren't we all ridiculous? And
right.
I feel like, yeah, if Jared helps sort of make the show less caustic than it might be without him, that's a great compliment.
Yeah. And it was fun to dig into your past a little bit and do some research, because it's kind of crazy. You started really early in improv.
Yeah.
And you know, you rose up through the ranks at UCB, right?
Yeah.
And then went on, you got on The Office, you got on this. I mean, it's pretty successful run that you've had, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. It's funny, I never, like, I kind of stumbled into it a little bit because I wanted to be a jazz musician when I was a kid, and I used to practice all the time. And then I got braces and I couldn't really play anymore, so I just had all this free time when I used to be practicing trumpet, which is what I played. And so I just sort of on a whim took an improv class up in New York and at Upper Citizens Brigade, and then I just really loved it, and I basically just wanted to keep doing that. Like, I never really had aspirations to be an actor when I started doing improv. I just thought if I could do like a day job and do improv at night, I'd be happy. But I never had any like grand designs to act on TV or any of that stuff.
Well, when you were little, like how old were you when you started playing trumpet?
I was in second grade.
Okay, so pretty young.
Yeah.
I mean, were you a kid that you could actually focus and practice?
I mean, it was pretty torturous, but I was like good at sort of a Spartan, like, miserable self-inflicted discipline. Like I was, my parents were not like riding my ass about practicing trumpet, but I would just like, I'd create all these systems for myself where it'd be like, I have to do 3 hours a day. And if I don't, I'll never have the life that I want.
Really?
I think at the time I was like, well, that'll be my identity. I wore a stupid fedora.
In second grade?
Not in second grade. No, that's like probably a second grade. I think like the only people who could non-obnoxiously wear a fedora are either in second grade or are like geriatric.
Yeah.
Like you have to be an old man or a second grader, and anything in between those is unacceptable. But yeah, I wanted to be a jazz musician. But before that, I'd had, it's interesting because it was with trumpet specifically. Like I had these piano teachers when I was a kid, and I never really practiced that hard for them. But they were these weird, one woman was named Nadia, and she was this Russian. She'd wear these like red leather pants, and she'd smoke cigarettes, and she was really critical. She would say these like, she said about my sister once, it was like a little girl taking piano lessons. She goes, Nora is fundamentally sloppy, and I worry that will haunt her whole life. Like about a little girl who's just like trying to learn like hot cross buns. But Nadia would burn down her houses for the insurance money.
You're kidding me.
You know, that's true. And then we had another piano teacher who was a Wiccan, who was this like, she like painted her face all white. She was actually very nice. But on Halloween, she would invite all of her students over to her house and have like a straight up like Wiccan Halloween. Like we thought we were coming over for like Reese's Pieces and like you know, ghost decorations. It was like you stood around a cauldron and she had like a scroll with your fortune on it, and then you'd burn it in the cauldron, and like it, and she lived with her mother who was this like withered old lady. It was I don't know, I'm like talking so much about my piano teachers. But those people.
Well, suffice to say you had to move to an instrument.
Yeah, I had to migrate to
totally a totally different from piano.
Yes, exactly. So those people never inspired me to practice. But then, yeah, with trumpet, for some reason, I was like honed in on it.
So go back for a minute to the systems of like I have to practice 3 hours a day.
Yeah,
because that brings up a question about nature versus nurture. If your parents aren't the, you know, I guess the cliche would be like the mom that has this need for the kid to be the greatest, right? But you say you sort of did this to yourself.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was very self-regulating from a young age. And so I think that then transposed itself onto anything I would try to do. I'd be very rigorous about schoolwork. I'd be really rigorous about practicing.
Were you hard on yourself?
Yeah, I was pretty self-critical. I don't know why, but I just like fixated on the identity of a jazz musician. Like I read the autobiography of Miles Davis again and again, and I was so obsessed with it. I think when you're a teenager, you're looking for who you are, and this seemed like some ready-made collection of outfits and habits, and I felt like I could sort of like, it was like a ready-made identity.
It makes me wonder like who you were among your friends. Like if you were sort of like outsider-ish enough that you were going to develop this identity that would give you something beyond school and beyond a social group.
Yeah, I don't know. It's funny, like, because after I started doing comedy, I never told anyone I went to school with about it.
You never told anyone you did comedy?
No, I would go up to New York and I would do these shows and take these classes, and I never told anyone I was in school with. I think because maybe I liked having this weird sort of like secret comedy life in the city, and I think music was a little bit like that too.
What did your parents do?
My father is a therapist, and my mother is a pediatric nurse practitioner.
Really?
Practitioner, yeah.
So how did that work? Like, I'm curious to know, with your dad being a therapist, if you know, that sort of crept into how he dealt with you, or how, you know, the expectations or the conversations.
I think so. I think it informed the way we fought. I think, like, as a family, when we would fight, it was like a very, the degree to which you would be successful in a fight is probably the degree to which you could be eloquent in stating your case or narrating your interior life, right?
You couldn't just say, this hurts.
Yeah, you'd sort of have, again, it's hard to know in retrospect, like how much was self-imposed. And also they were really wonderful. Like if I was in a fight with my father and I could express myself convincingly, he would often apologize. He'd be like, you're right, I'm wrong. You know, it was not a particularly hierarchical or authoritarian environment. You know, it's like, It was very equal in a way, but you just had to be able to describe what was going on with you.
So tell me about when you quit trumpet, like how that felt to have this whole identity and then have to give it up.
Well, I got braces and I couldn't really play that much anymore. The orthodontist who gave me braces was this, like, I used to hate going to his office so much because he was a really strange character in a way. He had like a picture of himself dressed as an orthodontist putting braces on himself dressed as Superman in his office.
What?
Yeah, it was so weird. And then he also had this giant wall-sized mural with him. It was a 3D mural of him dressed as an orthodontist putting braces on the animals in the jungle. He was like this like very strange guy, and he would always sort of joke with me about Dizzy Gillespie, but I hated him because he was the guy who was, you know, destroying my dreams in my head. I like vilified him.
Yeah, Miles Davis never had braces.
Yeah, no, that's true. Louis Armstrong never went to bed with a retainer.
No.
Yeah. So I, when I got braces, I just couldn't play in the same way anymore, and it was so frustrating for like years. And then eventually, I just realized that it was not really going to happen. Like, I was recovering from it too slowly. I used to take pliers and tear out the wire so that I could play, because I'd get so frustrated.
And then you'd have to go back and see
Superman. Just go see. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it was pretty intense.
And what were the fights like with your dad when he had to pay the bill because you tore the wire?
They were incredibly understanding, to the degree that he took me to my father took me to Wynton Marcellus's dentist in New York because he wanted to see if there was some way we could get braces that wouldn't mess up my playing. This guy was called Dr. Chops. And there's this guy, Dr. Chops, and I had such high hopes. I was like, Dr. Chops is going to save me.
By the way, do you know how unbelievable it is, the cast of characters in your childhood? From the Wiccan piano teacher to Dr. Chops and the 3D orthodontist.
It sounds not true, but it is, I swear, true. And yeah, Dr. Chaps just sold us like really expensive toothpaste and didn't have any solutions.
It's
and
like, we went home. Try this.
Yeah, he was such a charlatan.
It won't fix your teeth, but your breath is going to be great.
Yeah, he was garbage. I'm slandering Dr. Chaps. But no, they were very understanding because they knew it was so important to me.
Right.
But then when I couldn't play, I started to realize that like I like the idea of being a jazz musician more than I love the music. Does that make sense?
Right.
I think it might have been a little bit superficial. I think if it had really been about like how deep a connection I felt to music, I would have been able to withstand that. I think withstand the braces or whatever. I think it was more that I like the idea of a lifestyle or something.
Right.
Which probably didn't even exist anyway. Like how many jazz musicians were there in like 2006 or whatever, who were like, I think that the time to be a jazz musician sort of came and went a little
bit.
Yeah,
like in the 60s.
Yes, exactly. I missed it by like 50 years. I can't believe how much I'm talking about my like adolescent trumpet
traumas.
No, but
it's interesting, like, because I think that's probably what set you on the path to improv, because if you were still playing trumpet, you wouldn't have been going off to the city.
Right.
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 So tell me about that. How did that come about that you were able to go because you were still in high school, right?
Yeah. Again, my parents were just like incredibly supportive. They're like, if you want to take improv classes, you can do it and we'll pay for you to take the train up to New York. And I would just go up to New York on the weekends. And then after a while, I would start going up on weeknights.
What did that feel like to take the train by yourself and be in the big city without parental supervision? I mean, did it feel like, oh, my life's starting, or?
It felt exciting to have this like secret life with adults in New York. And it was a very different, you know, I went to like a pretty typical suburban high school, but then I was like, I don't know, I remember like in my first improv class meeting this British guy who wrote for the New York Times and feeling like, I can't believe I'm hanging out with a New York Times writer from, you know,
right,
Brighton or whatever. Like it felt like this, I don't know, it's just, it was pretty thrilling. And, but I was also exhausted because I would have to go to school. So I'd be coming back from New York. Once I got more and more involved at UCB, I'd be coming back from New York at like 1 a.m. and then I'd have to wake up for school. So I would drive home from the train station in the winter with all the windows down and the AC blasting.
Oh,
and
to keep yourself awake?
And you're just screaming like a lunatic, like just so that I didn't like fall asleep and drift into.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did your experience at UCB, like those early days in high school, color your high school experience?
That's such an interesting question. Well, in like subtle ways, like, okay, so like when I was in high school, it was pretty homophobic. I remember feeling like if my siblings or if I were gay, it would be like catastrophic, because it would be like, because in my surroundings in that world, it would have been social annihilation to be gay. And then I went up to New York and I met all these people who could care less about that. And just in that small way, I'm not gay, but I remember thinking like, oh, weird. Like, it seems like in this world, this is such a stigmatized thing. And if you take an hour and 20 minutes train ride, people could care less. That was like, I remember feeling like that was a sort of a revelation. Just the cultural difference, like what was valued, what was looked down on. It put it in context, and it made high school, I mean, I didn't have a bad experience in high school, but it did make the sort of potential claustrophobia of high school much better, because I was like, oh, there's this wide world out there that is not reflected in my daily experience in high school.
Did you have sort of a revelation or a moment where you thought, like, this could be my thing?
I remember loving to watch it. Was so unbelievably exciting to me, and doing it felt so engaging and thrilling, but I don't think I ever felt good at it until like 10 years in.
Like, really?
The first time I ever did a scene in an improv class, I went up to the teacher and I was like, so should I keep doing this? And he was like, you've done literally one scene, like maybe just keep taking the class. But I was like constantly wanted reassurance that I wasn't barking up the wrong tree. And even after I got on a team and, you know, had auditioned and been put on this team, I remember feeling like I'm the weak link. I've somehow snuck in under the wire. And it took a really long time for that to go away. But then once in a while you would have a show or a rehearsal where things would just click. And that felt so unbelievably good that it would be worth it to sort of trudge through all of the self-loathing to get to the next fix of that.
Right.
I just was addicted to the rare instances when it went well, and it was worth it to suffer in the interim.
Do you think that you gravitate towards the sort of high wire aspect of it?
I think the potential for humiliation is weirdly like part of what attracted me to it, because I think I was such a high-strung kid and I was so anxious that I think I was in the habit of like seeing where things could go wrong. So I was always sort of seeing the impending catastrophe and trying to stave it off. But in improv, you don't really have the luxury of being able to look ahead. The threat of humiliation is so present in the moment that you can't really look ahead or back. It sort of forces you to be in the present, because if you aren't, you will humiliate yourself. So it's like a weird terror-based form of meditation or something, where it like makes
you... Yeah, it's like the fear in the moment is somehow curing your anxiety about the future.
Yes, yeah. Right.
That's a weird thing.
It's really weird. It's like if there's danger, like if there's actual danger, right, you can't enter into some weird fight or flight thing in your head about a theoretical threat. It's like the threat is right in front of you. Like, so you have to kind of like
I wonder why you were drawn to that.
I think it was like it got me out of my head. Like, I don't know if people who knew me necessarily knew the extent to which I was like that. But yeah, inside I was like always like kind of wringing my hands about whatever.
Really?
The freak out du jour was, yeah.
I would think that improv gets even scarier when it's going well.
That's funny.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, for me, it'd be like, oh my God, for 2 minutes, this has been really great, and I don't want to be the one to screw up.
That's funny. Have you heard Conan's thing about white tuxedos?
No.
Conan has this thing where he's like, success is like a white tuxedo. Like, the first moment you get it, you're like, wow, I look so sharp in this white tuxedo. And then you spend the rest of the night trying not to spill anything on your white tuxedo.
Exactly.
And it's like, yeah, it's sort of, I could see how you would feel that way. I think with improv, in my experience, once it's going well, you sort of like catch a updraft and then you can relax a little bit. Like once you get that first big laugh or whatever, then I feel like your body relaxes and you can sort of ride the wave a little more.
Did you find all of a sudden that you just got better at being present or in the moment?
Yeah, I think I got better at being present for a couple reasons. One is like, once you've failed enough times and you know it's survivable, that calms you down a little bit. And also it's disappointing because like, at least in my experience, whenever you're learning anything, you have these like revelations and then you think like, oh, I'm just going to exist up here now. But then inevitably, you slide back, then you get a little better, then you get a little worse.
Yeah. And that's true for almost everything.
Yeah.
Physical or mental, that's true, I think.
Yeah, and then it's so devastating when you're like, the next time you're like, oh, I'm the same old me. Yeah.
I'm the same old me.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so a while ago, I tried to read the UCB book about improv. And I've spoken to a number of people on the show that do it. And one of the most interesting revelations for me about it is that one of the worst things you can do is try to be funny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's also the sort of the end goal.
Yeah.
To sort of be funny. So was that something that you discovered, oh, that's actually true, I have to...
First of all, I'm just impressed that you read the UCB manual. Like, that's such a technical thing. That's like if I, like, read, like, a Boeing, like Boeing's, like, mechanics guide to, like, how to fix an engine. Like, that's so, such specific... technical knowledge.
I don't know if you've read the manual lately, but it's not quite
it's not Boeing level. It's not aeronautics level sophisticated.
But you know, I think I find it fascinating because you can get better at it. And yet it looks like from the outsider perspective, it looks like, well, that person's good at it and that person's not, and that will never change.
Well, it was interesting. When I taught improv, there would be people who I would think like, oh, that guy's not that great. And then a couple years later, I would see them and they'd be astonishing. Like, I remember listening to an interview with Woody Allen where he was like, you either are funny or you're not, and it can't be learned and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, that's not been my experience. I feel like I've seen people sort of chip away at whatever is preventing them from accessing the funny part of themselves. And then when they finally get there, it's like amazing. So I just, yeah, I do believe that you can get better at it. I mean, I guess there's
some
people...
Did you go through that too?
Yeah, I think so.
What you're talking about is the process of learning involves failure, right? It involves falling on your face. And I was wondering if that was the case for you, if somehow going through this process of learning the craft and bombing and failing and everything, if it led to more self-awareness in general about being a human being and
yeah, I think so. I think it definitely did. Like, it made me more patient with myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I realized, like, okay, so this is sort of what a learning process looks like. And then when I started getting opportunities and things that I had, you know, in my dark moments, I'd be like, well, I'm never gonna be able to perform at that theater. But then I get to perform at the theater, and I would remember feeling so grim and be able to look back on that and think like, oh, maybe those grim thoughts aren't particularly accurate or meaningful. I try to remember when I feel intimidated or despairing or whatever, to be like, those thoughts and feelings aren't necessarily predictive of actual outcomes in the world.
Right.
They're just sort of a necessary part of the gauntlet you have to go through to do anything. I think it's, I think like, discomfort is the price of admission to like pretty much anything worthwhile. Like, interpersonally, artistically, like if you want something good, you have to endure your own limitations, you know, in a way that can be sort of excruciating, but then ultimately, hopefully, gives you access to something exciting or beautiful or,
right.
You know.
I love that idea that discomfort is the price of admission, because failure is the most interesting thing in the world to me, because especially when you're young, I think you can take a lot more of it. I think it becomes harder as you get older to fail because you have more stakes and you have, you know, less time and, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm really impressed by people who, like, particularly people who are very successful in a particular area, who then venture outside of that area into turf where they're not going to be so good, because then there's the double exposure. Like, I have a friend who's an actress, and she really wanted to do stand-up, but she was successful enough as an actress that if she went to open mics, they would say, oh, you go on first. And so then there would be all this pressure because all the stand-ups would be like, oh, why is she going on first? And so she couldn't really do it because she felt like the success in this one area gave her an unfair leg up in this other area or an excess of scrutiny in this other area. I don't know. People make fun of, like, Michael Jordan playing baseball or whatever, but, like, I think it's kind of amazing to, like,
I totally agree.
At something. Yeah.
And the woman you were talking about is Meryl Streep, by the way.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
She really wanted to do... She was going to... A lot of Chris Rock's Bigger and Blacker is actually just material that she wrote for herself, and then he ended up...
Clearly.
She sold it to him.
No, you know what? You are speaking my language, because I don't understand people who perfect a craft and do the same thing over and over again. You know, Michael Jordan's a good example, and how much grief he received for not doing the thing that makes everybody worship him.
Yeah.
Because I think the challenge part of any cycle of life is the best part.
Oh, that's interesting. Like
that's the romantic.
The striving is the part that's exciting. I guess I feel like with improv, though, it's still like I'll still have shows where at the end I'll feel like, oh God, no, Jesus, that was horrible. And I'll still have shows where I feel like that was better than I knew it could be. So I still feel like there are those like peaks and troughs.
Well, that's because you're 22.
Right. I haven't just been like eroded down to.
No, but okay. So how old were you when you started teaching?
I think I was like 19 or 20.
Wow. And you probably looked, what, 16?
Yeah. I looked like a wee boy.
So how was that for the confidence of like, okay, I got a room full of adults here.
It's interesting. Like one thing that was really nice about UCB is it really felt like a meritocracy, at least like when I was doing it, where if you were good, people would treat you with respect. And if you were not good, maybe less so. So I never felt like people were talking down to me or treating me like a kid. So by the time I was teaching, I felt pretty at home being treated as an equal. Like, even though I knew, like, oh, this guy's a surgeon at Sloan Kettering, and I'm, like, giving him notes or whatever, and he's, like, he's been through, like, two divorces, and, like, right. Like he's had all this life experience, but I still, like, I do know more about this tiny little thing,
right.
This little area, so I'll have to, like...
So tell me, like, what was it like when you would get a new class for the first time?
Initially, it was, like, a lot of, like, very humiliating, kind of campy exercises, which I actually think is a really good idea for an improv school, because if you get people sort of embarrassing themselves and being, it's like pantomiming balls, and you're throwing balls to each other, and it's just like the most airy-fairy theater school-y like stuff. And so anyone who's being sort of aloof or cool will either have to give that up or flee. And
right,
so it,
right.
I think it really like sets a good tone where you can't be standoffish or overly dignified. And so that's sort of how the classes would start out, with like goofy name games, you know, stuff that's very embarrassing.
Right. Yeah. So the surgeon, it comes in, yeah, is like, okay, this child is teaching me. And
right,
if he doesn't flee then, and then he starts having to do, I get that. I feel like you'd have to break it down first, right? You'd have to break people's expectations
kind of
down a little bit.
Yeah. And get them in the habit of committing rather than trying to be funny. Like rewarding commitment over wit or over having a comedic persona. Like, set up a value system where the thing that is praised is just, like, going, like, whole hog at something, as opposed to trying to be kind of like ironic and sort of remarking from a distance or whatever.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can imagine that if you come into improv and you want to do it, maybe your inclination is, I have a few things in my back pocket. That,
yeah, like when I'm, right, exactly, like last Sunday at the bar, I said this and it cracked up all my friends, so I'm gonna like do that thing. Or like, I know I can do like a really crazy Australian accent, so I'm gonna do that. Or like, whatever. Like, people have their idea about what makes them funny, and because it's so vulnerable to be doing a class, you wanna lead with what you think is your strongest stuff. But
yeah,
ultimately, that's not that helpful.
But I think what you're talking about is, like, improv is beautiful in the sense that it's a group of people who have found that it's totally safe to have whatever human impulse they want and be silly or be vulnerable or be whatever and not pay consequences for that.
Yeah, I remember being fairly militant about that like not letting people be made to feel embarrassed. Like, the more you're willing to be undignified, the better. Because ultimately, like you said, that's like a necessary foundation for doing something that actually is funny and isn't just like stupid, goony stuff.
And I wonder if like an improv class was required at the DMV before you get your license. If like society would be better.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I remember like being in a taxi cab going past a improv theater in New York and seeing all these like grown-ups doing some warm-up where they're pretending to throw knives at each other or something. And it was so lame. It was like so unbelievably lame, and they're all like just completely engaged with each other, and it's just so embarrassing, and they're doing it out on the street in front of this theater. And I remember finding it very touching, like just seeing like adults play in such an unselfconscious, humiliating way, but they didn't feel humiliated because they were just involved in it, you know? It kind of warmed my heart in a weird way.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's like, I know from my own experiences and my kids being little that period before they become self-conscious, before someone cuts them down at school, before all that happens, we are our most like free as humans, right? And I think that's the beautiful thing about improv to me.
I think often people lead with the part of themselves that is ironic or cynical or kind of like armored.
Right.
And that's usually the least likable part of a person. And then the most like vulnerable, sweet, like imaginative part of themselves that people are so understandably so protective of that because it's vulnerable, but usually that's the thing that is so endearing. It's a shame that like you're sort of conditioned to lead off with your like cockiness or your like competitiveness or your calculated charm instead of just being like, I don't know.
As human beings, we have the entire thing backwards. You're absolutely right. We lead with our armor and we protect the thing that if we showed it to the world, it would produce more love.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's people who are good at sharing it. I just think it's hard. I guess it's hard. This is going to be like the most name-droppy thing ever, but I was in the background of a scene that Meryl Streep was acting in, and I was like briefly talking to Meryl Streep. And Meryl Streep, one thing that I was so amazed by with her is you would assume everyone who talks to Meryl Streep probably wants a piece of her. Like everyone who's talking to her, it's their Meryl Streep story, as evidenced by this very moment.
Right.
She's so famous, and people have such strong associations with her. I would assume that someone like that would just, as a necessity, be a little, like, guarded. But the thing that was so fascinating to me about meeting her was she just seemed, like, just available to anyone. People would talk to her. She would just be, like, incredibly open and tell you stuff from her life that felt, you know, like, real and personal. And there was none of that. You know, you meet, like, really famous people, and they're usually a little weird and, like, a little bit standoffish because they've just been, like, burnt or, right, you know, whatever. Their egos have. But I thought that was such an interesting thing that someone who you would assume would sort of have the greatest need for protection was, like, so just, like, present and kind of, like, playful and there. I was sort of shocked by it.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Let me tell you about this week's sponsor, Quip. When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. I've been using electric toothbrushes for many years and I love them. And Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of the bulkier traditional electric brushes. And the guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing the right amount of effortless. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's going in your gym bag or carry-on. And that's great for me because I usually travel with a traditional toothbrush, and now I have an electric toothbrush that I can take with me. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. That's a pretty good deal, because if you're like me, you probably don't change your toothbrush head every 3 months. And now, with Quip, I do. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of the year, but Quip did. So find out for yourself why. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/offcamera right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/offcamera. That's spelled getquip.com/offcamera. So folks, this is a no-brainer. This is a great toothbrush, and I use it, and I fully support this company. So do yourself a favor, check them out, and let me know if you like it. All right, now back to the show.
The way you just talked about that idea of leading with your vulnerabilities, that's sort of a natural good transition into Silicon Valley, because I think that's what your character Jared does. He leads with the exact thing. He doesn't lead with his armor whatsoever.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good analysis. Before playing Jared, I played a lot of characters who were kind of assholes, like
Gabe on The Office.
Yeah, like, you know, these sort of largely powerless but power hungry, kind of socially inept, backbitey guys. It was such a relief to be able to play someone who is so motherly and hopefully warm to the other characters.
Well, did you initially, was he the part you auditioned for initially?
I auditioned for T.J. Miller's part, for Ehrlich.
Yeah. Okay, that doesn't
that
seem
funny?
Right at all.
I know. And then, I think we all did. And then I auditioned for Jared. But initially, Jared was kind of a different character. He was a little bit more like Gabe or someone. He was this, like, assistant to Gavin Belson, and he was, like, a little bit strategic. And
right in the pilot, he was
in the
different.
Pilot. But then, once the series started, they kind of changed it, and it became more like what it is now.
Did you want the character of Jared initially, or did you want the Ehrlich Bachman character?
Well, initially in the pilot, Jared wasn't, there wasn't much to him. It was kind of like, he wasn't that funny, you know, it was just kind of like exposition and...
Right, right.
So I think, like, probably at the time I would have been more psyched to get Ehrlich, but now I wouldn't trade Jared for the world, like, yeah.
And how did that transition occur? Like, once the pilot was over and it started happening, how did those opportunities come up, like, naturally that it became more of a even-handed ensemble of these guys?
One thing that helped was the first episode after the pilot was written by this amazing writer named Carson Mell. And I'd met him before on, like, a general meeting, which, you know, general meetings are, like, the bane of everyone's existence. But, like, in this case, a general meeting really ended up helping me because Carson knew me a little bit and knew my voice because we'd hung out and had, like, a nice lunch together. So in his episode, he wrote Jared, like, a little bit more in my voice.
Okay.
And then I was like, okay, I see where, like, Carson is going. And then I try to improvise a lot sort of in that direction and flesh out the character that way. And then the writers would, like, you know, the improv stuff they'd like, then they'd incorporate that into the next script. So one thing that I think is so cool about television is, like, it's an ongoing conversation between the writers and the actors, at least on a comedy or at least on our show. It's like they'll try something, you'll take that and run with it in whatever direction you're interested in, then they'll take what you did and incorporate it in the next episode. So I think, like,
right,
we sort of circled in on who Jared would turn out to
be. Well, does it ever happen for you where there's, like, a little line or a phrase or something that all of a sudden that opens up, like, it's a key to opening up who that person is?
Totally. There's always these, like, gifts. Like I don't know, even just the thing of, like, in one of the episodes, Jared is sleeping and he's shouting German phrases in his sleep.
Yeah,
and
I remember
that.
And
then has no recollection.
That's in the garage,
when he wakes
right?
up. Yeah, he just, like, wakes up and he doesn't know, and he doesn't speak German in his waking life. So that kind of thing, like, the idea that, like, he has this, like, violent, like, World War II era dream life where he's, like, guess maybe the Nazi. Like, I don't know. Just that he's so dissociated that he's, like, the sweetheart and when he's awake, but then at night is, like, in this phantasm of, like, terror, I thought was really funny. And then,
so
that,
how does that come about? Like,
well, that one came about. I'm Jewish, so I always try to say that before I tell anyone this story. Proudly Jewish, but when I was in college, I was asleep in my dorm room my freshman year, and I woke up the next morning and my roommate was like, hey man, you okay? And I was like, what are you talking about? And he said, you don't remember? And I said, no. And he was like, I was up late last night working on a paper and you went to sleep. And then in the middle of the night, you shot up and looked at me and went, I hate the Jews. I hate the fucking Jews. And then went immediately back to sleep.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I don't know what to make of that. Like, I myself am Jewish. But so I told one of the writers that story, and I think maybe that led to Jared speaking in his sleep in German.
Oh,
but apparently
God.
I'm a nocturnal anti-Semite.
You know what? It was probably the Wiccan.
Yeah, she like, right. She like planted some deep-seated self-loathing.
Right. Yeah. Oh my God. So that's a great example of the conversation. You tell a random story and then the writer picks up on it. But you know, it's funny, when you say that, I would assume that coming from an improv background, eventually who you are is going to come out. Because when you're improvising, you have to not think about what you say, right? Mm-hmm. So I would think eventually your life experiences, your viewpoints, your general disposition towards the world, that's going to creep into your work. Is that a valid...
I think so. I mean, I think it's funneled, right? Like, I don't think it's just like a vomitous, like outpouring from your subconscious in an uncontrolled
way. It's not like in your dorm room.
Yes, no, exactly. You're not terrifying your roommates in improv, hopefully. But I think it's... yeah, I think like what you find funny, what your natural interests are, obviously informs the directions you go. That was a funny thing teaching, where like there would be some guys where like every time they would do a scene, no matter where the scene took place, it would end up with them like screaming at their dad or whatever, and you'd be like, okay, so maybe you're like have some stuff with your dad. Like, it could be like a scene where they're like, whatever, two synchronized swimmers in a Busby Berkeley musical, but then somehow one of them would become the guy's dad and he's angry at his dad. It's like, or like sometimes weird sexual things that could like be recurrent, because if you're not a trained improviser, it is kind of like...
Your fallback.
Yeah.
Is you.
Yes, exactly. So in that way, you're very exposed. It always reminds me of those like... You know when they do like the lottery and the bingo balls pop up? Like, it's like some people, that same bingo ball like keeps getting produced.
There's one that's a little lighter.
Yeah, exactly.
So did you have anything that popped up ever in your career where you're like, whoa, that's...
I realized recently that like I've made a lot of NPR jokes lately.
Well, that makes total sense.
Yeah, it does, right?
But you were wearing a fedora.
Yeah.
Being a jazz musician.
It fits into the whole sort of like insufferable white liberal arts gestalt. Yeah.
With weird anti-Semitic dreams.
Yeah, exactly. That's me in a nutshell.
You should definitely put your iPhone on record before going to bed at night and find out who you really are.
I really should. My girlfriend told me the other night, I guess I was asleep, and I said, the magnitude is not dependent on the frequency. Like, I was doing some sort of science in my head. I think I have weird, angry dreams. I guess the science thing isn't particularly angry. It's just...
No, you're just emphatic.
Yeah, I was emphatic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. We could make jokes about this forever, but the pattern I hear coming out is like, you know, you were doing a lot of work in your head. And I think one thing that ties together a lot of really creative people is that they are constantly, some level of their brain is working on getting better at their thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to reconcile that with the, like, anti-Semitic screaming, but I wonder what I'm working on. But, yeah, I like the idea that, like, even when I'm asleep, I'm trying to get better, but I don't know how I can...
What about this idea of transference, though, of the writer trying to incorporate more, like you said, Carson knew you a little bit, mm-hmm. so he tried to steer the character towards you.
Yeah.
I mean, would it be fair to say there are Jared-like qualities that have made that character more three-dimensional just by the fact that you're
that
who
come
you
from
are?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, well, like in the first season, TJ Miller had, like, told me, I didn't even remember this, but he, like, apparently came into my trailer, and I was seated on, I was cross-legged on a yoga mat reading a purple journal of affirmations with candles lit around me, listening to the Indigo Girls. And so he was like, oh, this is, you're just playing yourself. like you're basically Jared. So I do think, like, yeah, parts of our personality naturally seek into the show.
You know, we had Thomas Middleditch on the show,
yeah.
And he is one of the quickest, weirdest, most original guys
I love him
I've ever come in contact with. Is that something where when you work with someone like that, and you're obviously a master improviser, do you two push each other?
I think so. And also just the way he works is so different from the way I work. Like, Thomas is so loose. Like on set, Thomas will be doing like bits, like voices, all this stuff. It sounds like when you talk about someone doing voices, it sounds annoying, but it's not. He's like so funny and so playful and so free. And he'll like get big monologues that he hasn't like memorized the night before, and he'll just like learn them and then go do them. And it's so just like fly by the seat of his pants, and the results are so amazing. Whereas I'm kind of compulsive about preparing. I'll learn the lines a week before if I can, and I'll call an acting coach and talk through scenes. And I feel like I've learned from him like that sometimes the way to best set yourself up for like a good scene isn't actually to like hunker down. It's to just stay loose and stay present and stay playful, and he's so good at that. So I feel like I've learned that a lot from him.
Yeah.
And also in terms of feeling freedom to go places that feel risky, I'd say partly I feel that from Thomas and the other guys on the cast, but mostly I feel it from the editing. Like I trust Mike Judge and Alec Berg to edit in a way that will like protect the character and protect us from looking like total schmucks. So you can do like really big, stupid stuff in the off chance that it'll work, because you can be confident in their taste in the cutting room and that they're not going to let something that undercuts the show or the character actually make it into the episodes. So that's where you really get the freedom to like try shit. Because it's scary to improvise if you don't trust the director, because they might use it. And if it's not good, you know.
Without being specific on names or anything, have you ever had that situation where you've gone for it and then found out that you weren't protected?
Yeah. You have. A little bit. Yeah, in certain situations, there's been instances where I've been like, ooh, that, you use that take? Like, oh, please, no. Please, no. But it's rare, but not unheard of.
I feel like the kind of art that you guys are making, that wouldn't work.
Yeah, I think you can't be precious. I mean, despite, I feel slightly self-conscious because I keep waxing philosophical about the nature of improv and whatever. Like, but the truth is, like, yeah, ultimately you have to be, you have to be kind of loose and not precious about it. You can have your ideas about how things should be, but if you're too rigid or you're too tied to your own technique, or I don't think it works, especially with a show like Silicon Valley.
Yeah,
you can get kind of too self-important or too, I don't know, enamored of your own process, and then you're no fun to play with, you know.
Do situations happen where you have the time to really play out an improv and really see where it goes?
Yeah. They're really great about that on the show. Like, even though, you know, time is money and everything, they'll let us play a fair amount. I mean, most of what you see in the show is scripted, but sometimes they'll pluck like a little piece that they like. And
right. And is it pretty egoless?
Yeah, that's a really nice thing. It's egoless from like top to bottom. So like Alec Berg wrote on Seinfeld, ran Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Silicon Valley. You know, these guys have like the crazy comedy resumes. Mike Judge is like, you know, an icon of comedy. These are guys who could be very dictatorial about their words and their jokes. They are like totally happy to let you experiment and try things. And often they'll like it, you know. And among the cast, too, we'll like try to set each other up a lot. It doesn't feel like you're gunning for the biggest laugh in the scene.
Right.
Thank God, because that would be a nightmare.
It must be reassuring and actually notable to see the best minds in comedy just throwing stuff against the wall.
I think it's a sign of real confidence to be collaborative. Like the fact that Alec and Mike are so willing to let other people pitch their ideas or play or try things, I think is real confidence. I think the guy who's like, I need you to say it just this way because I'm, you know, I know what I'm doing. That is brittle and like, and doesn't read to me as authentic, like,
right,
belief in yourself. I think the person who can allow for the unexpected is obviously the most confident person in the room.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I read something that you, I guess you said it in some interview, but you said that it's interesting when the stand-ins come on set for lighting or blocking purposes.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the show looks like a real show.
Yeah, well, okay, so like when the stand-ins show up, on set. They're like, we're the rare show where the stand-ins are better looking and like more conventionally attractive than the cast. So when they call second team and the stand-ins come in to set up the shot, if you look at the monitor, you're like, that looks like an actual TV show. And then we come in and it's like, I don't think we're like complete ghouls, but we just don't look like, you know, your standard, you know, it's not like a CW cast. Does CW even exist anymore?
I don't know.
You know what I mean? One of those like hot, like one of the, it's not like Gossip Girl or something, right? So, yeah, I think that's part of the appeal of the show probably is that it's like these like broken down losers and not, no one's, you know, you don't feel intimidated by the characters.
And I think Silicon Valley manages to be such a brilliant satire because it is so close to reality. And
I hope so.
You know?
Yeah.
I think that's why I'm attracted to it.
That's nice.
Yeah.
This is only like, this is so tangentially related, maybe not even related at all, but I was walking in the West Village once and there was these, you know, these like beautiful West Village brownstones. And I was like, who gets to live in these? Like I was looking like through the windows of, which makes me sound like a predator, but I was like looking through the windows, but on the television, my own face came on because they were watching Silicon Valley. It was such a weird experience, like, to be, like, fantasizing about these, like, crazy lives that these people must live and then see your own image, like, staring out at you from the street.
They're watching you and you're watching them. And
yeah.
That is creepy.
Yeah, it's super creepy.
Yeah.
I broke in and I, you know.
And did you stay for a while?
Yeah, yeah. I inhabited their identities for several years.
No, but did you...
No, I mean, I didn't want to linger outside someone's home, like gazing at my own image, like. But it was just a weird
but
thing.
But you sort
like,
of did.
Yeah, I mean, I had to masturbate to completion. Whenever I see my own image, I have to do that. Yeah.
Which fits with your story because that takes like 3 seconds.
Yeah, it's really quick. It's really quick. No, I just was like wandering by, and then I like did a double take, and then was scared I'd be thought to be a lurker, so I moved on.
That must be a weird thing about any sort of fame, that you have those moments, and because what you probably really want to do is knock on the door and go, hey, that's me! I'm on television.
Oh, how eerie.
Yeah.
That would be the scariest thing in the world if you were at home watching television and then one of the actors materialized at your door. It's like some bizarre Charlie Kaufman sequence or something.
Well, it fits right in with your whole story of just odd people in your life, right?
Yeah, I've become one of them.
Yes, you've become an odd person.
Yeah.
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 Walking through neighborhoods, looking to, you know, every Sunday night at what, 10 o'clock?
Yeah, I go on a prowl. I'm just like the most narcissistic predator in the world.
Looking for
just
open like, windows.
Jesus Christ. This is horrifying.
Okay, well, I have a question
that is
all related to this in a way. You know, play Gabe on The Office.
Yeah.
And as much as he's not like Jared on the inside, he's a bit like Jared on the outside.
Sure, like middle management.
Middle management, a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
And The Office was a big hit. And you moved from that to Silicon Valley. And now it's a big hit. It's like season 5 or something.
Yeah.
Do you worry ever about being typecast?
Yeah, a little bit. Like, I try to avoid now, like when I get sent stuff, if it's like an assistant role, I generally try not to do that because I think that can get a little redundant. Like being someone's right-hand man, you know? I try to steer clear of that. I don't want to just play guys who are these sort of like comparatively low-status assistants to people.
Right. I just wonder if you look at this and go, will my massive success...
Usually most of my thoughts begin with, will my massive success... and then there's just different endings to that.
No, but will the success of these two shows...
Yes.
And their longevity, will that produce a situation where, like, I have to fight against that now?
Yeah, I think it's possible. That's understandable, though, too. Like, I just wrote a movie, and when we talk about, like... casting it, you think about people in terms of what you've seen them do before. It's a natural thing. So I think you just have to be deliberate about choosing things after the, like when Silicon ends, I'll try to be deliberate about not doing something that's
but
similar. But also like ultimately the thing that I really care most about is just if it's good. I'd rather do something similar in a good project than do something different in a bad project.
Right.
But I'd more, I'd like to do something good in a good project that's different.
I totally hear that.
That was the most complicated word salad I've ever produced.
You don't want to be a grizzled hitman in a terrible movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I want to be a grizzled hitman.
I would watch it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you've been doing this for a while now, and I was just curious, I guess, if you think there are things that get harder as you get more experienced or things that you lose when you get further away from that young, like the early period of any band, that's the thing we want to hear. We don't want to hear the Rolling Stones' 16th album. We don't want to hear Steel Wheels. We want to hear Sticky Fingers because they were all 24 years old and they were playing with their gut.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Same with Miles Davis. I think we want to hear Sketches of Spain. We don't want to go...
like that weird electronic stuff. Like,
right.
Yeah, right.
Now I'm probably pissing off some like super jazz aficionados right now. But I guess the question is, does that analogy hold up for acting at all?
Yeah, I think so. In a way... okay, so... at the outset, like when you're starting like a show or a movie or something, you have all this anxious energy, but there's also a lot of work to do, like a lot of prep to do. And so there's a place for that anxious energy to go. It can go into your prep. But like, for example, in the fifth season of a show, I already know pretty well like who the character of Jared is. So there's still work I can do to prepare, but there's less. So if you have sort of just a natural allotment of anxious energy, then it's hard not to start to self... if you're not careful, you can almost start to self-cannibalize because it has no place to go. There's no productive outlet for it anymore, so it just turns into self-consciousness or neuroses or whatever.
Right.
So in a weird way, like letting things be easy is hard. Like just trusting, just letting go and saying like, I actually don't have more homework to do here can sometimes be... like paradoxically very difficult. And I think you have to be more disciplined about gratitude, I guess. Like I try to actively remind myself on set on Silicon Valley, I try to look around and be like, this wall isn't gonna be here at some point. Like this set will not exist. Like I will not see my friends every day. To actively remind myself like this is going away, so that you don't get complacent or you don't become numb to the blessing of your like own lucky situation. Like,
yeah.
Like my therapist told me, anyway, well, whatever, we're already heading down this path. My therapist was telling me, she was like, you know, in a lot of cultures, they do in the morning like a death prayer where it's like mass is sort of oriented towards mortality, or like Jewish, it's like Kaddish, I guess has a lot to do with death. And she's like, reminding yourself at the beginning of the day that you're going to croak kind of helps you show up for your day, you know?
Yeah.
And I think like when you're on something new or you're just at the outset of your career, everything is so exciting that you don't need help being appreciative. But as you sort of settle into routine, I think you have to do your like weird little death prayer in the form of like, the set won't always be here, as a way of like... sort of reactivating yourself and making sure you're showing up as much as you can.
So what we've learned here today is that you've replaced systems to make yourself practice trumpet for 3 hours with a death prayer.
Yeah. I'm
to appreciate
great.
Your life. It's never going to be that easy for you. Even if everything's going great, you're like... everything's going so great that I have to remind myself I'm going to die.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
But it makes me happy in some sort of roundabout way where I'm like, it's fleet. There's like, you know Thornton Wilder? Like he,
oh, yeah.
Like Our Town. He had some quote about
it. I was in Our Town. It was my one
What'd
moment.
You play?
I played the little brother who had one line.
Okay.
And then I die and I'm in the graveyard the whole third act.
Yeah.
And I got totally busted for chewing gum because I was supposed to be dead. I was on stage.
I
was sitting very
act.
Still.
Yeah.
It's a long third act.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I just had a little gum just to keep myself occupied.
I'm on your side. I'm on your side in that.
And by the way, if the dead can sit in chairs...
they can chew gum.
Right.
Chill out.
Yes.
Relax, guys.
Where's that drama teacher now?
Yeah, unbelievable. But anyway, Thornton Wilder has this thing where he said, like, eat your ice cream before it melts, you know, like meaning just like enjoy things, I guess, before they go away. And so I think about that a lot, too. That's my little, like, mantra. I'll be like, eat your ice cream before it melts, which I guess is sort of a Jared-y thing to say, too.
You're nothing like your character. It's a shame, because I thought you would be. Yeah, it's been fascinating to get to know you a little
bit. Yeah, you too.
Thank you for doing this and for, you know, letting me into your mind, because it's crazy.
Because it's a haunted house.
It really is. Yeah. But thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, man.
Hey folks, that's our show. Check out Zach's hilarious work in both Silicon Valley and The Office, and also in Steven Spielberg's The Post, which is less hilarious, but really good. Or just look out your window. Maybe he'll be out there in your yard. So, here's the part of the podcast where I tell you all about the different ways you can enjoy off camera. If you haven't listened to this part, I encourage you to stay tuned for the next few minutes for some very cool info on the show, and also for a preview of next week's guest. So, as you know, you're listening to the Off Camera podcast, but Off Camera is also a TV show available on DirecTV's Audience Network, Channel 239. We are on Monday and Wednesday nights at 9 p.m., and it's a great way to experience the show. But if you don't have DirecTV, don't despair. You can still see every episode in our archive simply by getting an Off Camera monthly subscription from offcamera.com. It's so easy, and it only costs $4.99 a month. You can watch them anytime on any device, as many times as you want. And for you actors, directors, musicians, writers, and other creative types, think of Off Camera as a masterclass on creativity. I know that I do, and I can say with impunity that I've learned more about my craft from doing this show than from any other source. So check out our monthly subscription, and you will immediately have access to a wealth of wisdom, and you'll be supporting this show so we can keep bringing you new episodes every week. Okay, that's my spiel. Go to offcamera.com and check that all out. And also, while you're there, we still have some signed copies of our photographic anthology, Off Camera, The Portraits, our 275-page coffee table book featuring my exclusive photographs of the artists that have appeared on this show. This book is printed in beautiful four-color black and white, and it makes a great addition to your library and a great gift. And if you want me to personally inscribe one to you or to a loved one, send me an email. I'm sam@offcamera.com. You can also send me an email with guest suggestions, a question, or whatever else is on your mind. I want to hear from you, the listeners of this show, and find out how Off Camera fits into your life. You can also find us and share us on social media. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. I also want to thank the hardworking and beautiful people that make this show possible. Our producer, Crawford Shippey, our editor, Nathan Shields, our graphics whiz, KK McGalvin, our studio manager, Sasha Snow, our transcriptionist, Kara Johnson, and our tile grout scrubber, Matt Davidson. And I want to thank you, the listener, for going along on this journey with me every week. I appreciate you tuning in, and I implore you to tune in next time when I sit down with actress Mae Whitman, who has been in front of the camera since she was 2 years old, and has a longer IMDb credit list than most actors in their 80s.
To be an actor, you have to observe, and I joined SAG at 2. So there's a tiny part of me that wonders, am I like a total sociopath? I just wonder, because I'm always a little bit outside of it and ready to communicate it. I just wonder, am I a secret monster that can never actually be totally present?
You may remember Mae from her childhood work with Sandra Bullock in Hope Floats, and with George Clooney in One Fine Day. But it was her role as the troubled teen Amber in Parenthood where Mae really caught my eye. She has an ability to bring a realism to her characters that immediately creates empathy and some serious crying. And if you had a hard time in high school, and who didn't, really, then you can take a trip down the memory lane of shame in The Duff, Mae's devastating portrayal of public humiliation and self-acceptance. But now, after 25 years, Mae has found new ground as an actress. She is playing an adult and doing it hilariously and deeply in her new show, Good Girls, about some good women who make some bad choices. Well, Mae has spent a long career making very good choices, with the possible exception of the culottes in high school. See you next time, off camera.